advice. And if you feel like giving something, you stop them and you put something in their level. So this fakir would be called by these people to sing before this. So this fakir would be called by these people to sing before this Majlub, who was to all eyes just asleep or unconscious, apparently asleep. So the fakir would be called, and the fakir would begin to sing. He would be asked to sing, and he would sing in a vibrant voice, you know. And as he went on singing, the Majlub would apparently regain consciousness. He would sit up. And they were all ready. The mat was ready, the water was ready, whatever had to be done was quickly done. And then the fakir was told the time. So slowly he would lessen his tempo and his tone and then stop. And as he was doing that, the Majlub would go back to sleep. So Baba said, but you have to sing from the heart. But then he said, see, you, where does sound go? He turned it out to us. Talked about sound. Where does sound go? None of us need to know. And Baba says, it cannot go anywhere. It cannot. It is there. It collects the sound of a gun, the sound of a child crying, the sound of laughter, good sound, bad sound, big sound, small sound. It all gathers. But you see, in the plan, in the divine plan, nothing is wasted. Even that which is not wasted. So all this sound is this force collects, and ultimately. So all this sound is this force collects, and ultimately that force is used to break the backbone of the illusion. To break. That this was Baba's gesture, and what is not is just broken with that. So then Baba said, if sound can do that, can apparently bring a Majlub back into apparent consciousness of the girl, what is that about light and what is that about? So then, from that I say that sound is a force, is a power. And we have the belief that so is vision, so is sight. How you look at something, it affects. There is a force that comes out from it, because it's not just blind sight, if you excuse the pun, because your mind, your thoughts color your vision. I'm looking at this, I'm interested in this, oh, she's this, he's that, you know, otherwise it's nothing. So they say that if it's a sight, that is najar, and we call it the good eye, meaning when you look at something with tremendous admiration and say, oh, how beautiful, something will happen to it. Because that force of that sight has gone in it. So matter.
Okay. Shattering, cracking.
What I mean is blemish. Some blemish would, supposing you admire somebody's beautiful lace dress, so then there might be a cigarette burn or a little ink spot. That is known as najar. That's why you will see in India, the little babies have little smuts of black put on around their eyes or on their cheek, so that it breaks the force of your sight of admiration. When you look at, first you say, oh, you know, that deviates, that breaks. And then you see the face. So that is already detracted from that force. So in that, coming to that, I mean, to me, like when Michelangelo's theater was, you know, blemished, even if it was by madmen and not something meaning to, look at the force of admiration that's gone by millions of people. Oh, look at that. I mean, it's repaired again, it's done again. But coming to that, well, the whole thing was about, so that sometimes when you see how Baba, to detract his force from our receiving it, his beauty, like a Darshan time Baba would say, he opened the door of his heart a little bit each time he would say that. So the Darshan was over. Right? There was a mass, big darshan, public darshan. Thousands had come. Each one had received from Baba. Each one felt that he received something individually, he or she. That is the way Baba would give to each. So even when there was thousands present. So Now, once darshan is over, he wants it over. You know, has everybody gone up from Guru Prasad? Has everybody left? There's nobody. And he comes to where we are. And that is the moment we wait for Maharaj as a household, a family, you know. He's changing his sadra, he asks what is there for food, what is... At that time, word comes in from Erich, from the men's side, that Baba so-and-so has come. He could not arrive in time. And everything had happened, the train was late, blah, blah, whatever it was. He had just come. He only wants a glimpse of you. And Baba, without a sound, groans. Oh no, like everything was done. And look at me, I can't even have a moment of this. But he still wants to see. He knows the love with which that person has come. Because the message is simply to give the message. It's as you want. He wants. So put on the sadra, he says to Mara, put it on. So Mara shakes the sadra out to me and puts it on. And Baba's ready to go out, puts his hand on her arm, and goes along with him. But then he turns around and says, where's my garden? Where's my garden? We always have a garden down. You know, even you see most of the things, at one time you see Baba puts his own garden down in one foot. But as soon as he said, somebody would come and garland it. But this was a paper garden, very pretty, pink flowers, made of paper at the top. And so Baba said, so Baba said, where's the garland? That was removed. And and I happened to be there, and I always being very smart. I said, Baba, no need for garland, Baba. You look so beautiful. I said to you. My motive was that the sooner he goes, the sooner he'll come back and give Peter Tom, you know, they're all looking for the garland. No, Baba was just the garland. And at last, the garland was brought to him, put the garland on, and he went. And later he explained that the garland breaks the detracts from some of that beauty, from the power of his beauty, the power of his love that he releases at the time, could not be taken without that break of the fall, as it were, could not directly be taken by that person. So, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. I mean, Baba was not going there before he could have the garland. So even when we ask for Baba, we're not ready to receive it. He can give. It's very easy for him because he is it. He has it. Like somebody said to Baba, when will you manifest, Baba, when will you... Then release your divinity when you will come out. And Baba said, that's very easy for me to do. What is difficult for me to do is to hold myself in. That is the most natural thing for me to do. And then, of course, being Baba, he gives a humorous simile. He said, if you have wind in the stomach, it's so easy to release it. It's so difficult to hold it in until it's the right time and the right place. That one understands the feet. That's what it's called. I mean, that's like this chapel always pestering Baba about whenever you come to visit about the God realized, you know, God realized versus God realization. And to us, it seemed, you know, we were just watched. It was like somebody asking for a toy. You know, we don't know what we're asking for, but we never wanted it. But we would just see it. So it's happening. So every time Baba would give some reply, at last one day Baba said, he said, there was no carpets here. The carpets are now for his royal family. It used to be just the bare flooring. So Baba says, you see this floor? The stone? It's a stone floor. So Baba points to the stone and says, see this? Yes, 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 Baba. Stone. He said, and then Baba asked him, I'm sorry, Baba asked him, what is the difference between you and an ant? No. What is the difference between you and a stone? Oh, he knows, of course. He knows the difference between himself and a stone. Oh, he said, yes, oh, yes. That is the difference between you and a god, realized person. The difference that is between a stone and you is the difference between you and a god, realized person. From that day, he never thought of himself. It's so beyond anything. Like children, they talk of... In the early days, when I first started writing as a secretary, I used to be very amazed by some of the things. There was a woman called Violet Dizilla, and I was very conscientious. I used to write long replies, you know. I would answer every question that came in the letter. And so, you know, I would just scream then. So one day when she asked and said, oh, she said, your so-and-so came to the meeting. And I'm sure he was on the third plane. And so it's okay that she was on the fifth plane. And I said, my God, how am I going to cope with her? So at last came the question, and what plane are you on? So I went back. I said, I haven't even been on an airplane. So I've got beyond that. Then came, he said, oh, illumination. Like the words were just, you know, faded. Illumination. Not that I'm anything bad. So, light. So, to see the light. So, I went back. I said, having seen the light in Baba's eye, the love in Baba's eye, what other light do you want to see? So, little by little, I brought it down. This is not... why miss what he's giving by asking for something you don't even know what it's already for? It's for him if he wants to do it with you. It's like loving somebody because an uncle, because you know that he's very, very rich and he will leave you so much in his will. Instead of loving him because it's your uncle. And with God, there's no bargaining like that. You're out of luck, you start with God. Just love him and you might
be. Tell them the figure that he used to give.
Yes, there's this banana. When Baba would tell us that about the spiritual thing, that is for him to explain that which is beyond the mind, because that is all beyond the mind. The mind cannot even touch the fringe of that which we ask questions about, God realization and this and that. You see, the mind cannot even touch the fringe of that. It's beyond understanding. And Baba said, it's like trying to smell a fly with your ear. We're not equipped for it. The ear is not for smelling a flower. So when we ask questions, he has to give us answers in the way that what we can understand. He does give. He never says, no, that's beyond your understanding. But he lets us know that which can be understood. And he gave us illustration which is so lovely. To me, it's one of the dearest discourses. And he said, suppose you have a child, a little baby, you know, a toddler. A child comes and asks someone about marriage. Just tell me about marriage. I want to know about marriage. How can that person explain to the little child what marriage is, what marriage involves, and the relationship between a man and a woman? How can all these things be explained? Sex, love, how can you explain to the child? So, because you cannot explain about marriage, the child is not equipped with that. You explain about the wedding. You say, yes, she wore this, and a beautiful padded lace for the ring, and the mother was looking, and the minister said this, and the cake was served, and she was so beautiful, and the ring was made of this gold, and infinite details you can give them about the marriage. The flowers, the church, the thing. But you cannot tell them about the wedding. You can only talk about the wedding to the child. You cannot talk about the marriage. But when the child grows up, he knows of himself, his own experience. He knows what marriage means. And then there's no question. He knows from his own experience. But till then, you tell about it. And so Baba actually said, all that I tell you also, I'm only telling you about the wedding. The marriage only takes place in love. So whatever, even words, whatever he gives us for our understanding is about the wedding. And yet we battle words and we ask him words and we think we know and we analyze and we... I tell you, we have heard Baba Ravis talk more about his silence than about the meeting. And it was amazing. Jajua was coming, so traveling all over India, talking about Baba's silence. So many lectures on Baba's silence.
This is
I think that some of us, we had to go around in a circle because I think, like, for myself, I can speak. I had no real interest in God realization or anything, but when I first came to Baba, there was God Speaks and there was the discourse. Can you read these things? The explanation about the planes and this and that. What? So you have to begin to think about all this. You have to your mind starts to try to understand. I'll be thinking that this is what you're supposed to do to be a Baba. You're supposed to understand what plane you might be on or what God realization is all about. You have to think hard about this because this is all you have. You have these books to look at, you know. There are a few photos of Baba and you have books to read. So then you have to go a full circle through all that and then you come back to it.
These books and these discourses and all these are gates through which you are drawn. I mean, how many have said that? But I mean, that's the way to a must have found Baba. These are the footsteps, you know. They do serve in that. But his main purpose to catch through those gates is his brothers. Yeah. Oh, that's why I was very scared when we heard that after Pune, you were still coming, and more will be coming, and playful will be coming, and you know, hundreds are coming, and I was very scared. I said, we ask questions, I mean, we don't know anything, you know. And I said, Eric, I said, do you think I should close my account with my son, you know, for a month and read discourses or something? I said, ask questions for a while now. So I was very wary. I said, if anybody asked that question, I said, will you please go and ask Adi? Eros will be able to tell you. It's so hard for me. I thought, it's not that. It's not human. They want to know about Baba's humanness, which is right. Because we receive this God through Godhood, through his humanhood, his human ways. So, oh, then, very much in trouble. They want to know where he's at, what he did. These Baba stories that... There is no end to the Baba story. He makes them, and we are ready to tell them, whether we can or not.
We were also really not to have to know that we had to know all about the world.
Well, happy new life to you all.
Happy new life.
Thank you very much.
I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown. And he replied, go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. It shall be your better than light and safer than a known way.
When we were in Bangalore in 1938-39, Baba at that time had us all celebrate our birthdays. And we were a lot of us. We were over 30 women. And each one's birthday was to be celebrated, so that there were birthdays practically every week. And each one had to give a present to that birthday child, every one of us. Now, there was no freedom of shopping. We couldn't go out shopping to buy presents. We never had money to use. We couldn't ask anybody else to bring presents. But from whatever the Westerners had given or we made or whatever, there was, so we would start giving out presents. And then when you got 30 presents on your birthday,
who kept them, you know, hoarded them. Because you knew you'd have to go back to study to the 30 birth of the girl. So it was just a circulation, an exchange. And after a while, the delight was you'd get back your own present. They didn't remember it was yours. Or I didn't remember that Elizabeth had given me this. So her present would go back to her on her birthday, things like that. That's a real circulation. That's a real circulation. It still goes on. Ready? But
he's talking to your heart
as a vocational. The children. They have to earn it by guessing which hand it is in.
When we were in in 1952, when we were in the States with Baba, when we left the States, the day we were to leave the States in 1952, during our visit with Baba in Myrtle Beach, Baba said I was to keep silent till we got to India, which meant from there to Switzerland, England, and here these those and Pakistan, and here till I got here I wasn't to speak. So fine, we didn't speak. But Bessie, the coloured lady who worked for Elizabeth, oh, she was a darling, in a plump, and Bessie was just Bessie, and anything I said would sound funny, and you know, Bessie would always be having fun when I was around. So when I tell her about the little phones that we had at the center in the cabins, to communicate the cabins with each other, they were the kind you turned a handle, you know, reminded me of a coffee grinder. So I said, Bessie, you got a coffee grinder? We're going to play it together. Oh, Miss Manny, you're going to be the death of me one day laughing. You know, and she said, so, for the last day before we leave Myrtle Beach, Newport Dunes, and I said to Bessie, from tomorrow I don't talk. Oh, Miss Manny, I was going to, you know. I said, it's all right, Bessie, I can make faces, you know, it's all right. Then when we left there, but we had so much fun on the way. So many people had fun. Even I may not have had it, but many people had fun. And when we were in England at the Rubens Hotel, and we had to go down to the dining room, each one in turn. I could only talk with Baba, so when I got into Baba's room, I could talk. The rest of it was silence. So I'd go down, and the lift boy, the little English lift boy with brass buttons and a little pillbox cap, was very interested. Somehow it thrilled him that he was somebody who was dumb, you know. But the waiter kept saying, "Blimey, she can hear, but she can't talk." You know, it surprised him that I could hear, but I couldn't talk. And I just glared at him, sort of, "You just wait, my boy, till I can talk." So when I go down, here was this head waiter with the coat tail. You know, the coat, kind of evening coat that has tails, like a swallow, you know? And he had a hearing aid, this little elderly, very, very British, very dignified. And as soon as I get into this beautiful big dining room in the Rubens Hotel, with wonderful food, by the way. It abolished all this myth of English food not being good. It was top, absolute top. So he would bow to me, and he would say, he would lead me on and draw a chair and ask me to sit. And he knew that I couldn't talk, whatever. And he'd hand me the menu, and he said, he'd read out the menu. He said, "I'll read out the menu, miss. And any time you like a dish, just nod your head, miss." And I said, "Thank you." So, but I didn't know the names of the dishes, the menu. I mean, he read it out, but I couldn't understand them, you know, what they meant, what they were. So they weren't familiar to me at all. And they were extraordinarily grand names, you know. And so every now and then I said, "Bam, bam, 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 bam." Not. One tic-tac-toe round I go. Not. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Not. And every time I nodded to the right dish, it was superb. And then after I'd said it, he'd tick. Every time I'd nod, he'd tick, you see. And then he'd call one of those waiters and tell them to bring all these things for me. And I was having a grand time. So then Delia came down too for breakfast. And I never could get over the thing of the English having fish for breakfast, kippers and all. And I was so amazed. So one day Delia said to me, "Would you like some ginger beer?" I certainly nodded my head. And I was, in fact, I was hoping there would be beer in it. It happened, it wasn't. Anyway, whatever. I love soft drinks anyway, or anyway. So, that's it. So she got this ginger beer for me. It came, the waiter brought in a big mug, just like those English kind beer mugs that, you know, there was a lot of foam on top of it. And the best part of it was she opened her purse, she took out a shilling and plonked it on the table. It was just like old England that I'd read about and known about. Anyway, no talking. So when you're going up to my room from the dining room, the little page boy would always ask, he knew I was going to the third floor, he knew. But, you know, it's as if he was holding in something, and he'd ask, which floor, miss? And I knew it was a game between him, and a little, and I did this. And his eyes were just popped. I could just see he was waiting to go home and tell Mom what happened today. And I said, yes. So, no chance. Then, this went on through in Switzerland. In Switzerland also, I couldn't talk. And I had two funny things happen to me in Switzerland. One day, Irene Billow was going shopping for our lunch. You see, Gisela was with us, happily girl, and they would cook. It had all to be in a budget, you know, but they made it delicious, really delicious. The only thing is that in the evening time, we used to have something sweet. That's a Swiss way. They can make a meal of something sweet. They can make a meal of a dessert, in short. A dessert can be a meal. And I realized that later, because when in the ashram, when somebody would send sweets, Indian sweets or whatever, Baba would distribute them immediately. You know, each one filed by and you got your share, whatever the thing was. You couldn't possibly eat them all together, but then we would try and keep them in old tin boxes, or each one had to do their own thing. But Irene Billow, the Swiss girl, would sit down and eat her share. And it used to amaze them. But we realized why when we went to Switzerland. So here we were under the tree, beautiful big tree. Outside, this table was set, and Delia was there, myself, Charmian, and Samantha, and we were eating. Baba and Mera had it in their room. And there were lots of little apples falling from these apple trees there. So Gisela's children and I, we would go and collect them, you know, for fun. I just helped them collect. They were the ones who were collecting. So they made this beautiful dish, dish out of these sweet apples. So it was a dessert, it was a sweet dish, and a big bowl, and there it was on the table. And we were eating. And Delia wasn't taking anything on her plate. And I knew what was happening, but I couldn't talk. So I said, Delia, not now, thank you, no. And she went on talking. And I knew that she thought this was dessert, and that the food was coming, and she was waiting for it. And I knew she'd have to go to bed hungry, because this was it. You know, but it was very good, if you like. So Heidi came, Heidi Martin, lovely, the beautiful Babalo, and she said, Delia, this is... And she said, no, thank you, Heidi, not now, thank you very much. Oh, dear, I said, now she's again missing out on that. So this went on. And then, at last, she got the idea that this is it. So she took a little, and she said, I can't understand it, not even a salted biscuit. I can't. And then... At that time, moment when she's frowning, Heidi comes, and Delia turns and smiles and says, oh, very nice, Heidi, very delicious, thank you very much. And then Heidi leaves, and Delia says, now I know, that's why the Swiss are so fat. And while she's going on, like, Heidi comes back again, and not anymore, thank you, Heidi, that's quite enough, thank you. It says, I couldn't talk. Then we went for shopping for our afternoon meal. They made some very delicious things, you know, omelette with vermicelli and things in between rolled together. So the Swiss dishes are just really very good. Anyway, we went shopping. So Irene took me with her. Anyway, the silent, dumb girl went along with her. And there I saw in this glass case a sight I'd never seen before. There were a lot of little pig snouts, only the snouts. And a pink. And their nostrils were like almond shaped, you see? And here were these snouts. And I love to try anything once. I mean, even if it's something exotic, you know? I take it, even if it's not tasty, just so I could say, look, I've had that. You know, I've had a rabbit. That's why I had a martini on the plane.
So she said, Irene said, well, either it depends on the money. If there's enough money, we will take the snout. If not, we'll have to take the fish. You wouldn't believe it. Baba's sister prayed to Baba. Said, Baba, please let me the snout.
Oh,
Baba, you don't want me to come back again. This is in my next life. You want me to finish whatever it is. And so when she came back and said, looking at the yes, she said, fish. I said, all right, Baba. But on the plane, when we were on the plane going to the math fish, Baba said that we were free to eat. There were no restrictions, because otherwise everything we had restrictions. Our life was just restricted in every way. Nothing could be done without Baba's direct direction. Everything had to come from him. So this time we didn't ask him. We were in the plane and we were free. So we were free in our seats, you see, in the plane. Fine. So that was all right, because what happened while we were free in those plane seats was that food came every now and then. There was a tray coming every now and then. That was lovely. I mean, you didn't have to cook for it. You didn't have to wash the dishes afterwards. You just were served. They put a little pillow on your lap, and they brought a tray, and then they took it back, and they brought another tray. And on the tray would be these... I'd never seen a poached egg before. So there were these big, white, poached eggs with the yellow... looking like eyes, Eddie Cantor's eyes inside. You see, if I move the tray, those yellow yolks turn brown instead, you know? And it reminded me of Eddie Cantor. So I was having a lot of fun. Now, I didn't know any of the others would be airsick. I didn't know there was such a thing as being airsick. So Meru, who was next to me here, I was by the window, kept refusing the food now and then. And I kept it. And every time they asked, the stewardess asked her, "Can you want something?" She'd say no. But these trays would pass under her nose right onto me, and I'd have every bit of it, because I wasn't airsick. So the stewardess said to her, "Don't you want something? You're sure not going to say no to everything?" Mary said no. "But look at her," she said. The stewardess points at me and tells Mary, "Look at her. She never says no." And I said to myself, "Why should I say no? We paid for it. Elizabeth has paid for it, you know. We're in first class." So then I tell Meru, I said, "Meru, don't refuse. Whatever she brings, say yes and that, and then pass it on to me. It's been paid for, don't you see? And I will take my favorite dishes and the rest can go back." Then, not only that, but along with the meals came, the next day, for lunch, a bottle of champagne. This big. Now, I've always wanted to taste champagne. I've heard of how they drank champagne in women's slippers in France, and I've heard of champagne at every wedding, and champagne at, you know, congratulations in a bear when a son is born, always champagne. I've read books to Baba, so I should know. So here was the champagne. Oh, I was so thrilled. And I told Mary, "Don't refuse the champagne. Pass on the bottle to me." And we were free. We know where there was no... I didn't have to go and ask Baba, "Can I have the champagne?" So I opened the champagne, and I was so disappointed. The champagne wasn't champagne. And I said, "Perhaps you have to drink it with slippers. I don't know." Anyway, it didn't. But the later on, when the students came and asked everybody what drink would they like, see? And my ears pricked up immediately. I said, "I better make it something that I always remember, something I've never had." So then I thought, look, I read these Rex-style books to Baba, and I read other detectives' books to Baba, and often the other detectives, I mean, Nero both drank beer, but the other detectives would lean against the counter smoking and order a martini. So I said, "A martini, please." Now, I didn't know what was coming, or even how it was going to be served. And she takes it as natural. She comes with this glass with a thin tin and a big, you know, blown up, very, very pretty. And inside was looked like a green beetle right in the middle. I took it as if I was used to it. Thank you. And it was delicious. There wasn't enough of it, but it was so good. No, wait a minute. We're not supposed to talk about martinis. We're going to have Jeannie sing.
Did you enjoy it?
Did I enjoy it?
Yes.
Very much. Very much. Oh, boy, do I enjoy it. I love it. Never have it. But if I'm ever to have a chance and Barbara says have it, I'd love it. That's why even when we were in England and we were by the River Thames and we saw the swans sailing, all this is so familiar to us who knew so much about England, so lovely. So then we stopped at a little eating place and everybody ordered something, just we girls, and I looked and I said, I must have a rabbit because I've never had it. So I can someday say, oh yes, I know what you're talking about. You know, a rabbit, yeah, sure. So I got this rabbit stew. And Delia kept saying, but that's not tasty. That's what the poor people eat. And I don't care. Well, I'm gonna eat. And, no, I'm not supposed to talk. You're supposed to sing. Ones who were coming there for the first time, how nervous they were to meet the Mandalay. Oh, I was so delighted. Now, that's when I confessed. I said, don't worry. I said, I was just as nervous when you were coming. And Mary was saying, too, but what are we going to say? What are we going to talk? What are we going to do? And then when it happened, and when y'all came, and I was so happy because most of the time, what you want to know about is the human side of God. What as man on earth? What did he like? Where did he sit? What did he? And that not only touched us, but that is the real questions you were asking, and the right questions, because we know from experience that receiving God through his man form is far more profound, far more stupendous than through one's knowledge and reading and trying to learn in some way. Just in that intimate human touch, that is where I've seen Baba being revealed more than any time. Also, for instance, it is as if the human form could not contain his Godness completely and wholly. Just like a garment that you wear, which is what you call his body, a garment. When you wear a garment, and when it's getting used a lot, and when there's a tear in it, it reveals the body. So we found that more often, at the times when his body, which he wore out in his love, in his love for his creation, for the world, for his lovers, for each of us, that then when his body was worn out and as it were torn at tears, that's when he was revealed more clearly than before. And we have found that, like, for instance, after Baba's accident, when his body has been broken, when he has looked helpless, when everything has seemed hopeless, and, you know, that is the time when people who were skeptical or doubtful, people who could not see, in fact, who could see his reflection in us, but could not see it in him, who prayed for us, like the missionaries in Sathaya. But when that happened, they have had a glimpse of God through that man form, through that garment. And we have seen how the time when Baba had this accident in Sathara, and we were leaving Sathara for good, blown out like an explosion from Sathara, the place that we had begun really to love, the place we felt most at home in, and the place Baba gave us hopes for a more lengthened stay there. We'd already been there, I think, 3 years. And Baba said, how do you like Sathara, huh? Very good, huh? Oh, yes, Baba, so nice. It was so quiet, and yet it had everything very well balanced for our life, for our style of life. It was just so perfect with Baba.
And then we were just catapulted out of there. But before that, while we were there, there were these missionaries, Westerners, who were doing a lot of good works. Like all the missionaries do, they're wonderful people, but they could not understand about Baba, the Christ. I mean, there was Jesus Christ, and that was that, you see. But they somehow could see something reflected in the people around Baba. So Dr. Donkin, Dr. Goher, who were most involved with them, you see, they could see, and they were prayed for them. So then, when the accident happened, we thought, well, that's finished. I mean, any little effort we could have made to bring Baba to them, to their consciousness, to their acceptance, well, that's, chances are finished. I mean, there could be no chance after this. Oh, Mary Baba's gone. Now he's Christ. Look at him. He goes in this accident. So we forget about it. And yet, that's why I say, he reveals himself through those tears of his body. So when we were leaving Sitar, and you know what our mood must have been with Baba, and we look out, and we see those missionaries, women, the ones who are most strongly opposed to the idea of acceptance of Baba as the Christ, they were standing there with such reverence. And the look on their faces, they were bowing. My God, you could only see Catholics bowing like that in that church. And so just that one glimpse was enough for me to say, Baba, how could it be? Now they see you. Now they accept you. Now and here you're broken in body. And we're going away like, running away from Sitara. And all this that they expected Baba to do, and sort of miracles and this and that. This is what's happening, and that is the moment when they see. And they did. You could not mistake that when you looked at their faces as I did. To me, I mean, I carried that image of their faces right through to Pune. It was so wonderful. So anyway, and I'm talking about being nervous and frightened. In a Baba's gesture, for anybody who's scared, frightened, nervous, was like this, you know? Don't be. No, with both the hands straight out like that and shaking. And don't be frightened. And this, the once when Baba did that, he was recalling. It's wonderful how Baba would recall some incidents that happened years ago with Baba, in our life with Baba. And we would forget. We'd forgotten long ago. But Baba would recall that particular incident at such a particular time that, for instance, so once when Baba was telling somebody, don't shiver and shake like those two people in Dehradun. That was years ago. We can't grasp it. We can't remember. And then it suddenly comes, and then everybody bursts out laughing. What had happened was when we were in Dehradun, in that bungalow, in 1953, in walked a couple of street performers, just two. They're a pair, and if you allow them, they come in and they do an act, a little act. You know, nothing tops, nothing particular, just a little something. Instead of solo, they just do it, this duo, and I was surprised that Baba allowed them to come in. They were both men, young men, but one dressed in the dress of a woman, the kurta, like we have. And in fact, the only real indication that she's taken the part of a woman was an old knee, this headscarf that we the Indians wear on. See? So she had that, and that sort of thing. Now, she became Laila. And the other one became Maju. And that is the greatest love story in India that one has ever heard of. And it's not like Romeo and Juliet that it's thought of or imagined. It's a real. It's a real story. It's history about Laila and Maju. In fact, when Baba would give us an illustration of anything that comes near to about divine love, Baba would use that illustration to show us that even that is not enough. For instance, Baba said how, he said, even the highest of human love, so pure and so high, that it touches the divine. The divine love that we know nothing about. Like Laila Majnu, which is the highest of human love. Even that love which touches the divine, because Majnu, the lover, in the end saw Laila wherever he looked. He could see the image of his beloved, no matter where he looked, and yet it was human love. So Baba said human, even that height of human love,